Welcome to the Commentary Magazine Daily Podcast. Today is Tuesday, June 2nd, 2020. I am John Podhortz, the editor of Commentary. With me, as always, senior editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Senior writer Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
And associate editor Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
So another night of rioting, a brilliant decision to impose a curfew on New York City at 11 p.m., leading to 3 hours of untrammeled looting from Macy's on 34th Street up Fifth Avenue to the Best Buy in the 40s and North Face store in the 40s and various places in Times Square, a Rolex store at 53rd Madison. And then I guess the curfew hit and people sort of went home, which raises the question of what happens tonight or what happens for the rest of the week. Because, you know, there seems to be an almost geographical nature to this, where they're sort of systematically moving uptown, and that means what's left are the Upper East and Upper West sides of Manhattan, which are largely residential with some retail, expensive retail, and you know that's where it starts to really terrify people.
Yeah, I mean, if there's an analog to the most, you know, grandest of riots in New York City's history, the draft riots. That was the progression. It was 3 days of northward movement. And it had that, those riots had very much an anti-class feel, which I'm a class war feel, which I'm not sure is entirely applicable to these necessarily, but it isn't hard to envision a scenario in which the eat the rich sentiment manifests in a desire to do what the draft riots did, which was to target residencies, upscale residencies, uptown after they moved away from commercial venues. Because once the commercial venues are all hit and there's not a lot to do, you can either have what happened last night, which is they just simply disperse. They did not target residencies last night. Or they can resolve to expand their targets.
Well, so can I just eat the rich prompted, which someone spray painted on an Apple store here in D.C. a few nights ago. The concern in D.C. About last night, we had an 11 p.m. curfew on Sunday night, which obviously led to something similar to what happened in New York last night. We had a 7 p.m. curfew last night, and a lot of neighbors, we all were meeting yesterday during the day to make plans because all of the storefronts in our neighborhood and in a lot of D.C. areas were boarded up after all the looting that had happened Sunday night. And the concern was, so where do they go next? Will they go to residential areas? I will say in my neighborhood and in the neighborhoods that were heavily looted the previous night, there was a much bigger police presence, literally blocking streets off and preventing people from coming in. It turned away some of the protesters who were violating curfew and headed towards our neighborhood. They literally had to change direction. So we were spared that. But so I think for New York, if that's, there has to be a pretty big show of force or a show of people on the ground saying, no, you cannot keep looting, because where we saw looting last night in D.C. were in the areas that hadn't had that police presence before and weren't boarded up, like in Chinatown and other parts of downtown.
Well, I'm sorry, Abe, you continue, but I want to set the stage a little bit for what happened last night.
Abe, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that I guess it depends whether or not they switch to residents is a question of whether how – what are they in this for? If they're doing this for swag, you know,
right,
for the goodies, which some seem to be, then there's no thrill in breaking into a home, really. I guess you could try to loot apartments, but that seems like a much more complicated prospect. I mean, but if there's some aspect of this where it's the eat the rich sentiment is mixed in with the let's get a duffel bag full of merchandise. That's where I think it gets kind of interesting.
And it's easier because the commercial venues are largely undefended by virtue of the 2-month lockdown. But just to set the stage a little bit, my concern is that the policing strategy won't change appreciably. If they're smart, it will. It did. This policing strategy was very hands-off last night, as it was the night before. And there was no excuse for that because they knew this was coming. That's why they put in the curfew at 11 p.m. The Deputy Commissioner for Intelligence and Counterterrorism, John Miller, said early on Monday morning that they had intelligence indicating that there were increasing presence of outside groups. They were organized. They were developing strategies for sophisticated communications and scouting. And they had medical units, and they had shock forces, and they were preparing weapon stations throughout the city, bottles, rocks, accelerants, and they were aware of all this. And nevertheless, they did nothing to prevent what happened.
Well, here we have the central issue, which is the attitude of the of governance. Remember, the mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio's daughter, was arrested among the protesters. And I was trying to sort of think of an analog to this. And basically,
Amy Carter.
De Blasio is directly the manager manager of the New York Police Department. These protests were against the police. She was out protesting against the police. He is the head of the police force. He then tweeted that he was proud of her for her behavior and has been tweeting or saying over the course of the week some stuff about the cops who work for him. You know, like, that cop who did this, he should lose his job or something like that. This is all him. This would be as though, you know, the head of a company, you know, the head of Deepwater, the head of the BP, right, owns Deepwater Horizon, and then there's the oil spill, said, you know, that guy who runs that boat, he should be fired.
Yeah.
It's him, you know. Like, you can't, you know, he's acting as though he doesn't run the police department. So what does that say to you? That says to me that as somebody who arose and partially got elected mayor on an anti-police platform, opposing the tactics that police used for you know, close to 20 years and helping to kill the crime wave in New York City, that at a moment at which the cops need their mayor to have their back, because there is widespread social disorder and mass criminality going on, they know that he doesn't, and he doesn't have the capacity, let's say, in his own person, to scare the criminals into thinking that they are really possibly in a great deal of trouble if they take on the police. Quite the opposite, I would say.
No, it wasn't just him. It was, you know, there was, I think it was a Bronx DA or Queens DA, one of the district attorneys who, in the midst of the height of the violence last night, you know, was shot out a tweet saying, if you're party to or witness to police violence and acts of police vandalism or excessive uses of force, you know, this is what you should do, and this is how you should behave. And it was just completely detached from the episodes on the ground, and demonstrates the wall against which police find themselves up against, you know. How are they to mount these?
If I could, I just want to read an email I got from a very thoughtful friend of commentaries. And here's what he said, and I want you guys to react to it. Traditionally, demonstrators don't cross red lines. In another era, burning down a precinct or destroying a police motor pool would have been considered a direct attack on police authority and would probably have elicited a deadly response, and the demonstrators would have known that. But what are the red lines today? They must be out there, but they are unpredictable. Threatening to swarm an immobilized police car, is that a red line? Apparently not. Starting building fires? Apparently not. Which buildings? Elements among the demonstrators are trying to press matters. Where is the official line at which they have gone too far and they will know that they have gone too far? Where are the informal lines for line police on the ground where they will have gone too far? This whole dynamic risks new sources of outrage and escalation, and alternatively, a de facto abdication on the part of the unsupported police.
So there was a video that was making the rounds from a few nights ago in New York, where a cop drew his weapon and pointed it at a bunch of violent protesters, looters. And I think even de Blasio commented on this, like, this guy should lose his badge. This is terrible. Why is he pointing his gun at unarmed people? You know, 24 hours, 36 hours pass, and we find out the context of that video, which was that he drew his weapon after his supervisor, another officer, was struck with a brick, you know, quite in the head and fell, and they were coming back for more. And that was the only option he had, was to pull a weapon, and he'd never fired it. But even drawing a weapon in a situation where they were trying to kill a police officer, and by the way, several have been injured in St. Louis and in New York and it's in the boroughs as well. So I think that the fact that their boss was chastising someone for defending a human life while in the process of doing his job, and the vitriol that was rained down upon the police when that video initially started circulating versus when the context of the video was explained, I think it says a lot about how, I mean, I can't imagine being a police officer in those conditions when you're being filmed doing everything you're doing about your job, and your boss is basically saying he thinks your job is illegitimate in the first place.
Well, we saw a lot of episodes of vehicular assault yesterday, vehicular assault in the Bronx in on police formations in Buffalo, New York. The scanners were apparently lit up with, we were talking about this over the text thread, that right around our area, that police were being visited by airmail. Christine, can you define what airmail is?
Airmail is a sort of euphemism, not a euphemism. It's a term for when anyone out of a high window or from a roof of a building throws stuff down at unsuspecting cops below. That's the kind of lingo. It's airmail, meaning it's bottles, it's rocks, it's deadly stuff that's potentially deadly thrown from rooftops or high windows down on police below.
Yeah, so police are being threatened with lethal force from these demonstrators, and I don't know how you expect them to behave. Save to use the threat of lethal force and retaliation. That's the job description. And I can't imagine that the general public is not absolutely fed up with this nonsense at this point.
I don't know. I mean, the video of the cop getting struck by the car in the Bronx is just horrific. I mean, that could well be another death. By the way, the man in Dallas who was beaten up over the weekend died yesterday. So they seem to be trying to find where that line is every night, and the protest, the rioters, and they're unable to find it. They keep pushing farther and further every night in search of when there's going to be some pushback, and there hasn't been.
But there's one thing more on Abe's point. There's a cognitive dissonance here too, because if you even raise that issue, the response tends to be, how dare you? We're talking about police violence. You know, a man died because at the hands of police. You're not allowed to discuss this other thing. Like, as if you can't, you know, have these two discussions going on at once. But that's a very powerful thing that's been constantly used in these debates about how to respond and where the lines are drawn. Is that you can't even talk about drawing a line because we're supposed to be talking about this other thing. And granted, like, we've all on, you know, yes, we should. We need to talk about that other thing, but we have spiraled well beyond that argument when other people.
And there's no one to blame for that condition but the violent demonstrators in the streets.
Right. Okay. I mean,
So there's a generational question here. In 1991 and 1992 in New York City, forgive me for going back. I mean, it's 30 years, so that's a long time ago, right? But David Dinkins was mayor of New York City. And it became apparent that when there was a racially charged incident involving cops and civilians, that it was his bias to side with the civilians against the cops. And there was a particular moment when a man named Kiko Garcia was shot in a stairwell in Washington Heights by a police officer named Dennis O'Keefe. And, de Blasio showed up and he went to visit the family, and he said the city would pay for the funeral of Kiko Garcia. And then it turned out that Kiko Garcia was a violent drug dealer and that the cop was in fear for his life, which turned out to be the case. It took about 2 days or 3 days for the story to emerge, but that the mayor had sided with a drug dealer, a violent drug dealer who had, I think, pointed a gun at the cop, and had presumed that the cop was guilty of this act of bias and brutality was one of the hallmarks that led to Rudy Giuliani winning the mayoralty of New York City the following year. Now it is 2020, and I guess Noah's point and the whole question that is raised by what we are seeing here is, what does the silent majority, if there is such a thing anymore, what do ordinary Americans think about what they are seeing on their television? Are they the populace of New York City in 1991-92, in which they are like, no, we side with the police against hoodlums, and the fact that political authorities are now moving literally to a position where they are siding with hoodlums and illegality against the police means that they have discredited themselves and they need to be thrown out of office and we need to be governed by somebody else? Or is this a different country with a different set of attitudes? Or are both attitudes being expressed at the same time by this wildly disparate and divided populace? And we're basically just going to fall up along, you know, ideological lines here.
Well, look, I have a guess as to that, but I don't think it's worth speculating on it. We will get hard data to the effect one way or the other sooner rather than later. It's almost irrelevant because policymakers in American urban centers now are faced with an existential crisis in a way that they had not faced in the last 40 years. Simultaneous events, the pandemic, which is a function of density, the economic crisis, and now these violent demonstrations in these inner cities are going to push as much of the tax base as possible away. 30 years of work shifting the narrative about American urban centers, making urban centers attractive places, has been undone in the course of a spring. And if American mayors and American managers of urban centers want to make sure that they can keep these enterprises functional, they have no choice but to behave in a way that maintains the tax base.
Well, look at it this way. Bill de Blasio is out of office on December 31st, 2021. So what does he care? Honestly, what is his professional standing after beginning in 2022?
He's an outlier. He doesn't like the job to begin with.
Well, no, he's not an outlier because he had it for 8 years. The thing is that he is going to want to be some kind of a progressive voice for the rest of his life. So the idea that he will act in ways to ensure the city's long-term viability and vitality, that goes against his own personal interests. His personal interests are now being as left-wing as he can be so that he retains his credibility on the far left, which is where he is going to position himself for his post-mayoral career. And he isn't even 60 years old yet, or he's just 60 years old or something like that.
Well, our friend Kyle Smith at National Review has an interesting thread about this question of what happens to the cities and are we going to have a repeat of people fleeing to the suburbs with their resources, you know, setting up their new restaurants out there where they probably don't have to get, you know, civil unrest insurance riders on their property insurance. And will we see this retreat? And I think that you likely will. I mean, you'll see some of that if cities don't respond pretty quickly with the sort of law and order type discussion. Now, the people who suffer the most when that happens aren't the suburbanites. They're the people who are left in the city who either can't afford to leave or don't want to leave. And because the tax base falls, there are fewer resources and yet there are higher demand for you know, the state to provide resources to them. And you have a stagnation that you know, we know how this turns out. We know how that story ends. Right. And I think if you add to that the ease of telecommuting work now and what the pandemic has done to change people's minds about having to come into an office every day, that actually exacerbates the situation. So,
But let's talk about what we were talking about like just 2 weeks ago, or what Noah was talking about. And the very interesting example is, of course, Noah's favorite politician, New Jersey Governor.
Don't say his name. He's like the Voldemort of this podcast.
Yeah, yeah. Because, of course, what you had was the phenomenon of these Democratic governors and mayors and stuff like that acting quite authoritarian in response to the coronavirus, right? I mean, you had Bill de Blasio saying to the you know, to the ultra-Orthodox Jews of Brooklyn, you know, this is it. You know, we are going to use the full force of our powers so that you can't go to a funeral, right? Now, granted, I'm parodying this because he had a point. There was a point to be made about how mass gatherings had to be stopped in order to prevent the spread of the virus and that people were ignoring that. But of course, remember, I have a message for the Jews is basically what he said, right?
And everybody else, though.
Right. And then everybody else.
Mostly you Jews.
Andrew Cuomo's like daily thing. Don't think that you can just go out and do whatever you want. Gretchen Whitmer making not letting people sell seeds. Everywhere you turned, and Phil Murphy saying, you know, whatever it was that he
said. Don't be a knucklehead. You know, I'm opening up the beaches. And this was,
I'm going to turn this car around. I'm going to turn this car around.
When you drive the highways, you literally see don't be a knucklehead on those little digital displays.
Right. So the point like is they were enjoying being authoritarian and putting their big thumb on the populace. Suddenly there is an event that offends liberal sensibilities and, you know, and everybody's sensibilities, but in this case that, you know, folds into a larger long-term narrative on the left about, you know, police brutality and systemic racism. And suddenly Phil Murphy, what did Phil Murphy say on Friday about, or whenever it was?
I want to get the exact quote.
Okay.
Because the shamelessness of it is so egregious.
Oh, and de Blasio too. So de Blasio on Friday says, we are going to protect the right of everybody to peacefully protest. Mm-hmm. That is the most important thing in America. By the way, you always get the sense from the left that the most important thing about America is the right to have demonstrations. That is, America is about demonstrations because, of course, the leftist narrative of America is the Haymarket riots.
Yeah, but also, right, demonstrations don't work unless they're violent. That's the other message, right?
Right.
You must demonstrate. But I mean,
the history, the leftist history of the United States is how demonstrations ended up changing everything in wonderful ways for the better. And, you know, we can go into whether that's true or not, or whether in fact what changes things for the better in America is the participation of the citizenry, both in self-governance and in peaceful political changes expressed at the ballot box, which is actually what does it, and representative government, where the elected officials are responsive to the populace. But nonetheless, so there is this narrative history about demonstrations. So any leftist politician or liberal politician is in the sway of the dream and the fantasy that the most important thing that they can do is allow for protest. Anyway, so they are then challenged by the fact that there are going to be mass protests at a time when just a week earlier, they were like, if any six people put their toes in the water of Rockaway Beach, we are going to pull them out of the water and beat them within an inch of their lives.
Yeah, okay. So this is the quote from our governor. He's asked about the George Floyd protests. And I said yesterday that New Jersey did pretty well around this. And it did largely, but there were some violent protests in places like Trenton and Atlantic City. Governor Murphy said, it's one thing to protest what day nail salons are open. And it's another to come out and peacefully protest about somebody who was murdered right before our eyes. So let's dissect the shamelessness of this statement. Anybody, and our governor was among them, who advanced lockdown and phased reopening, not just as good public policy, but as a moral imperative, saving people's lives, has covered themselves with such dishonor. Because what you're saying in that is not your nail salon that you can get your hair done and how obnoxious.
How petty that is. It's
how petty that is. It is providing for your families. It is conducting commerce and using services that not just make other people's lives better but make your lives better, but put food on people's tables. That is what we should be looking askance at, because the true virtue is in demonstrating against this particular cause. And John, you really deserve a victory lap here, because you've called this. You've been saying this for months now. And if you go back to our podcast, I found it, by the way, you go back to the podcast where we had Ben Shapiro on, you talked about how liberal politicians would need a change in incentive structures to all of a sudden engage in a conspiracy that wasn't really a conspiracy to deem the problem solved, the problem being COVID-19. It has been deemed over because the incentive structure, the competing values in the liberal imagination between protesting, riotous violence in against systemic racism and police violence vastly outweigh a public health crisis?
I don't know that it's been deemed over. It's just ignored when it
that
comes.
That sentence is deemed over. If you dare reimpose these restrictions on people who just happen to be policeable because they defer to authority, you will see an incredible backlash.
Right, but that's just them. I mean, that's like they're the exception, or the protesters. It's like, you know, when people talk about the abolition of the death penalty in this country, they always say that, you know, huge majorities are against it, or against it, or increasing numbers are against it, or against it. And then there's always a group. You say, well, what do you think about terrorists? Should we kill the? Oh well, yes, yeah, terrorists. You should. I believe in the death penalty. So it's a selective over.
The issue here is that some people are policeable and some people are not. And if we're talking about lockdown strategy, which exists only insofar as people allow themselves to be policed, then it's unenforceable. You're talking about lockdown exists only as long as the gathering is small enough to disperse.
Right. What is Bill de Blasio afraid of? Was he afraid of attacking ultra-Orthodox Jews for the crime of going to a funeral? Right. No, he wasn't. Why? Because they're not part of his base, and because he knows that they're not going to come after him. I mean, a lot of people came after him, but you know, he knows that they're not going to go riot in the streets.
But it's worse than that, because I think he also knows that by cracking down on that particular population, he's sending a signal to people who are in his base who would like to see that. You know what I mean?
True. That, yeah. Right. But when it is costly to him, but forget whether or not he actually secretly supports the riots and all of that, which obviously he does. I mean, I'm sure he doesn't support looting. Because why would he? Except that he probably doesn't like private property, but we can put that to one side. When he's in that position, and this is something that is really important to him to oppose and to sort of get stern about, he gets stern about a non-criminal population going to a funeral and is mildly supportive of the ethos and beliefs and a belief structure of people who are at the very least kind of siding emotionally with the notion that it peaceful protest that trails into violent protest is understandable. It's an understandable emotion. Like, where was de Blasio saying, look, I understand that you want to go out to this funeral to commemorate the death of this rabbi who was so important to you, but you cannot do that right now. You are going to make other people sick. So noble as your sentiment is, you cannot do that. He had no sympathy whatsoever. And this is what I'm talking about. So the hard line of the coronavirus, which is you're going to kill people if you do this, right, which is a theoretical thing because we don't know who has the virus, we don't know how they're going to get killed and all of this, as opposed to not being stern when you know that people are going out and taking garbage cans and smashing in windows of businesses and destroying them. And some of those businesses are small, you know, they're not just all Targets run by Dayton Hudson. You know, they are small businesses whose owners are ruined by what just happened. And they don't care.
Right.
I mean, they care, whatever. They care. It's really, you know, you shouldn't do that.
Well, but this is where I think language, not to get on the sort of Orwellian track here, but I think it's been really fascinating to see the below the waterline debates about what to call people who loot. I mean, I call them looters. I call people who beat up, tiny women who are defending their property thugs, because, you know, those words actually are applicable in those situations. But we were all just texting earlier about how now the AP guidelines is telling reporters, you know, we really shouldn't use the word looter because it has racial overtones. No, it doesn't. People who steal, who break into under the cover of mob violence into stores and steal stuff are looters.
Hey, let me read what the AP guidance is on this, okay? Because it's worth hearing. Quote: limit use of the term looting. Some have long viewed the word as carrying some racial overtones, particularly in the wake of natural disasters. Sensitivity is heightened now in light of President Donald Trump's looting and shooting tweet and the history of that phrasing dating to the civil rights era. Instead, use a few more words to describe the actions. Quote, some protesters broke into the store and stole whatever was on the shelves. For example.
That is a literary crime beyond using, right? Avoiding concision. When right. Writing a report is a crime against journalistic and best practice, yeah.
And
let
the
alone
voice.
This cognitive notion. And you know, you hear this about like the word urban, like you're not allowed to say the word urban as though it doesn't describe urban areas. it's an effort on the part of veiled racists to promote veiled racism. For some reason, the only people who are attuned to this veiled racism are anti-racists. Actual racists couldn't hear this code if you shot them full of sodium pentothal. They wouldn't have any idea what you're talking about.
It's funny because I'm this novel I'm reading, and the narrator is this Gentile man in the living in New York in this century, and he says that he has guilt over using the word Jew. That it's a secret among Gentiles. When you say Jew, you feel as if you're being insensitive. That you're like, you know, saying something evil. Like he prefers to say Jewish people or something, you know, something like that.
What novel is this?
I think it's called To Wake Up at a Decent Hour.
Ah. Anyway, that's yeah, right. Anyway. Yeah. So. Let me take a pause here and shift a few gears and talk to you about one of our newest sponsors, Tommy John Underwear. I know that sounds like a little bit of a strange tonal shift, but here we are. Because we're going into Father's Day, and Noah and I both being fathers on Father's Day, we know that our particularly now, it can be stressful trying to find the perfect gift for dad. Thankfully, Tommy John, the revolutionary underwear and clothing brand, knows that comfort is for everyone, even your dad. So gift him the softest, most breathable base layer he's ever worn. Their new and improved men's underwear is now twice as durable as his current pair and infinitely more luxurious, guaranteed. Plus, Tommy John is offering their best Father's Day deal ever with 25% off site-wide, including easy-to-gift sets that you can order straight from your phone directly to dad's door. So all Tommy John's layers are built for next level comfort. Whether you're on the hunt for lounge pants, lazy day joggers, or the softest Zoom tees and polos your dad has ever worn, Tommy John has you covered. Remember to get your order in before June 17th to ensure that your gift arrives before Father's Day. Tommy John is so confident in their underwear that if you don't love your first pair, you'll get a full refund with their best pair you'll ever wear, or it's free guarantee. Tommy John, no adjustment needed. Tommy John has the perfect gift for all the dads in your life. Deliver comfort to dad's door with 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/commentary. That's That is TommyJohn.com/commentary for 25% off site-wide. See site for details. Now we got to go into classic presidential politics. Things are looking bad for Donald Trump, and I'm saying that not, I don't want people to get mad at me, and they're going to send emails saying that we don't get it, and we're just so hostile to Trump and all of that. Morning Consult poll this morning has Trump's favorability in the handling of the riots at 20% versus 54% who are opposed, and then everybody else is somewhere in the middle. I checked with a couple of people I know who are a pollster, no history polling and all of this. Nobody can remember a time at which a president got a number of 20% for the handling of a crisis ever. Just to give you a contrast, the violence surrounding the Ferguson riots in 2015, something like that, Obama's approval disapproval was 41-53. Trump is 20-54. Now, what does that tell you? I think it tells you that half of Republicans think that Trump has mishandled the riots, and one can presume that maybe they think he's mishandled the riots because he's a paper tiger. That is, he's raging, he's talking about shooting looters, he's talking about, you know, being the president. I am the president of law and order, as he said yesterday
And he doesn't look like that at all. He looks like he's kibitzing like a caller to a talk show. He's on the phone with the governor saying, you all look weak, you know, do something so I'll look better, basically. And all I'm saying is, imagine that he handles everything perfectly from here on in, though I don't think any of us even knows what handling it perfectly would mean. We now have bad numbers for him with the virus and bad numbers for him with this. I mean, the worst numbers of his presidency for his handling of this. This is very, very, very bad for him.
He is promoting the notion that he could blame shift here correctly and, you know, absolve himself of some responsibility. And he hasn't really done that. He's saying, you know, I'm going to call out the military. He can't do that. He's not really allowed to do that. He can invoke some congressional measures to that would allow him some more leeway there. But a military response to these riots is the National Guard's province, and this is a state level issue. They're under the authority of state level officials, governors.
Well, except in D.C., he has a little more leeway in D.C. just given the weirdness.
And by the way, what happened last night? There's two things that happened last night. One is pretty atrocious. The other one was pretty good. And we have to separate the two out. The first was before the curfew was imposed at 7 p.m.
in D.C.
At around 6:30.
Wait, a curfew, by the way, that was established by our mayor, not by Trump, which people have confused about.
Right. So before that curfew went into effect at about 6:30, there was a gathering of peaceful demonstrators in Lafayette Square, which is right across from the White House. And police officials, police's cordon began moving forward. And then according to officials within the police, that they issued three warnings, park police, they issued three warnings to these demonstrators to clear out before opening fire with non-lethal ordnance, well ahead of the curfew. The reporters who were on the ground there say they did not have warning and were not aware of these warnings. And they were right up front. So there's some dispute about whether or not that actually occurred. Nevertheless, cleared out this park in order for the president to have a photo op. He wanted to demonstrate that he wasn't in the bunker so that he could walk for the first time in his presidency from the White House across the square to this church that had been set ablaze last night in order to have a rather facile photo op before a church that had been boarded up, holding up a Bible for about 2 seconds before walking back to the White House. And then the White House made this really glitzy video of it to demonstrate that it really was just a photo op. That's not good. That was bad. But then what happened later was military officials, National Guard officials, to the extent that they could do so in coordination with police, where police had jurisdiction, really rolled up these protests really effectively in a way that the president could say, look, this is the model. This is what you should be doing, American cities, urban centers, governors. This is what I did. Now you need to do this too. I think that would be an effective message. I'm not really sure whether they're making it.
Go ahead.
Can I push back a little bit? I don't think the photo op thing is so bad. I mean, I don't think it's not crazy to want to see the president of the United States appear to be out and about and actually taking some action during a time of crisis. It's a historic church. It'll be bad if the message about opening non-lethal fire on peaceful protests is
that warning is the exacerbating tensions at a time of maximal tension.
Okay, but to a couple of things that we do not have confirmation of. A couple of things: there are some reports that and there have been throughout these peace that I would call them quasi peaceful protests in front of the White House. There have been bottles and glass bottles, not just plastic water bottles, rocks, bricks, bottles. There have been things thrown at law enforcement who are there, you know, keeping a, and I know this because I know members of law enforcement who are doing those jobs. So it's not, when we say peaceful protests, let's make sure that we understand that the kind of verbal and occasionally physical efforts to assault the officers there is real. So I'm not downplaying what any stupidity that Trump administration might have done here. The second context is that I think Noah's right about one thing, which is there was no reason to do this 15 minutes before curfew. Now, there were a lot of curfew lawbreakers out there last night that the DCPD, with help from other law enforcement agencies, did an excellent job of trying to cite and summons. They were, many of them were placed under arrest, although not jailed, it should be noted. They had their hands zip tied. They're given a summons to appear in court in a few weeks. So that was good. And for the residents of DC who saw a lot of lawlessness and looting and violence on Sunday night, that was reassuring. And the military brought in to help protect around the White House to free up those officers to be around the city keeping order was a good thing. But why Trump couldn't have waited until curfew began and then said, okay, now we're under curfew, I'm going to go visit this church. Why he didn't call in advance to talk to the rector of the church, who, by the way, is extremely liberal and hates Trump and is, you know, no fan of the administration. But he should. There were certain sort of things he could have done as a matter of courtesy and political savvy that were just ignored because this is where I agree with you. I think he just wanted his photo op. So that was just dumb.
And wanted the images beforehand and yes. wanted to yes, demonstrate right. that he was not observing Mayor Bowser's curfew, that this is a courtesy that is not undeserving of these protesters.
I mean, let me use vulgar language here. I mean, everything that the president is doing is half-assed. The speech that he made I'm the president of law was half-assed. He decides he wants to make a show of going out and not being afraid of the protester. He did it in a half-assed way, ill-planned, ill-thought-through, saying I'm going to do this at 6:30, and then basically giving the Secret Service and the Park Police or whoever no option in some ways but to scatter the crowd as they might, right?
They didn't even know he was coming. Right. Some of them only found out as they started coming out of the White House. Oh yeah, now you got to move. I mean, right.
Impulsive. Spontaneously and impulsively, and this is the opposite of where you want it. You want things, if you want to display command, control, and a sense of seriousness, you think things through and you do them in a competent way. You don't expose yourself to the notion that what you've done here, you've done solely in order to make a video. You don't give your political rivals hay. You don't make hay with your political rivals by having them have an issue to beat you over the head with. And you don't have video images that lead lunatic blue checkmark and idiot CNN reporters and anchors to say, you know, we're on the verge of a dictatorship. You know, some of us would say in the most ironic way, holla-vi, that we should have a dictatorship. You know, if we had a dictatorship right now, then maybe everybody would be off the streets and the looting would stop. You know, what we have is the opposite of a dictatorship. We have cities that have descended into anarchy, literally anarchy. And far from being a dictator, Trump is a paper tiger. He is showing, this is what I mean by he's only slid to 20% favorability because Republicans are running in the other direction away from him because they're looking and saying, why isn't somebody doing something about this? And he is failing us. And if those people go away and every one of them doesn't come back, forget the fact that he was already facing an uphill climb, according to polling, before all this started. I mean, he needs to get every single one of those people who says that he is not handling this well in his camp back in his quarter. Or, you know, he literally might as well quit right now and not be president anymore because he clearly doesn't want to be. Why would he want to be president at this moment? Like, it's a horrible job. It's horrible to have to deal with this. It's horrible to have to deal with the virus, everything like that. So, you know, quit before he's humiliated in November because he's got a huge task here now simply to get his coalition back behind him. And again, he can get 90% of it. He can presume that 90% of it will come back behind him. And that number of 20% approval would go up to 35 or 36%. But if it's not where his overall approval is, he can just kiss this election goodbye. And everybody who was listening to me, that's not me wishing it. That is, I mean, it really isn't. And don't shoot the messenger.
Well, and this is why I think it's incumbent. And I spent a lot of time yesterday after National Guard troops were coming through Washington, and they brought up, you know, some military police from Fort Bragg and to come serve as backup. If you're in DC, you found out Sunday night that we did not have enough law enforcement people on the ground to contain, you know, looting and rioting. So when those, you know, when those images were shown on TV, I had a lot of friends who, people who are very dear friends of, who I love, saying, oh my God, you know, how, this is it. This is the end. Like, the tanks are rolling in. It's Tiananmen Square. I mean, they were really, and they're honestly feel frightened, because their fear is that Trump, you know, is going to command these troops to slaughter American protesters because he hates the left or, and the media. So my response was, and I tried to explain this to them as thoughtfully as I could, I was sort of relieved, because first of all, Trump, I agree with John, is a paper tiger. He's in thrall and sycophantic when he's around military leaders in general. And I would probably rather, you know, have a four-star general calmly trying to keep order in a very, you know, in a very small way on federal property around the White House than I would Trump sort of, you know, doing his crazy thing. So I actually found it reassuring, but I'm more law and order than my friends. But I do feel like, especially among conservatives, we need to be very careful about inflaming those, the sort of inflammatory rhetoric about Trump being a dictator, when, and instead focus on what he is doing very poorly and what a lot of conservatives feel he's doing very poorly, and not talk about how, you know, this, we're on our path to fascism or dictatorship, because I think that actually is not helpful at this moment. We do not need to exacerbate or exaggerate his missteps here. He's just making it very evident.
In an age before people consumed that many, too many Facebook memes, you know, the notion that, you know, we were on a pathway to fascism or civil war would be limited to the historically illiterate and over-caffeinated, for whom we can safely ignore, you know, they're unjustified opinions, but they have an over too much influence on the discourse as it is.
I have a question, and it's not, I'm not asking it rhetorically as a defense of Trump. It's an honest to goodness question. What should he be doing now?
Well, I have no idea, because he lost he lost crucial days. I mean, that's right. The only way you could, in other words, like, he needed to respond to this properly the minute that it started by right. saying, I'm calling all the governors, we're going to have some kind of a thing. You know, I am consulting with, you know, I want there to be a sort of task force of law enforcement officials countrywide to da 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 da. I am consulting with the military and the National Guard. I'm suggesting that the governors call out the National Guard, being calm, being resolute, so he lost all that.
And establishing the limits of his authority, not setting expectations that people don't understand he can't meet, like he's going to call out the military and impose military force on states that have not requested it, which he is constitutionally unable to do.
Well, it's exactly. Not, yeah. It's, I mean, look, the other thing to be said, and which is important to be said, is that when this happens, if this happens, in other words, and it has happened, like in 1967, there were tanks on the streets of Detroit during the riots in Detroit. That's one of the reasons Detroit died. I mean, by the way, I mean, I don't know when this ends. I mean, there may be no alternative in some places, but the application of at least paramilitary. I mean, the National Guard is the military. So, I mean, you don't need to call out the, you know, the Pentagon. You can use that. National Guardsmen are effectively a military force state by state under the command of each governor. But
I don't know how this ends either.
This
but the
is
first
triage. In other words, if you take, if you send out the military, that is, you know, that is triage. And the consequences of that, where it happens, will be severe beyond all reckoning. If there are tanks on the streets of Minneapolis in order to prevent, you want to talk about flight? So the New York story is, in 1970, the population of New York City, or 1980, the population of New York City fell to 7 million. It had been 8.5 million in 1940. It was 7 million in 1980 because of almost 20 years of crime. It is right now 8.5 million. So they all came back in population terms. Everybody came, you know, everybody came back, and they're all going to go away. But Minneapolis is like a city of 400,000 people. If 100,000 people leave Minneapolis, Minneapolis turns into Detroit. It loses its tax base. It loses its revenue. It loses its downtown. It loses its sports. I mean, granted, Detroit didn't lose its sports team, but it could lose its sports teams over time. everything about the city will die.
Every city in America is facing that threat. The task right now is to put this violence down, perhaps through maximalist means.
But I'm saying the day after that's
over is for every major city in this country to end the lockdown 100%. There is a quote, right? The hypocritical imposition of these rules that are only applied to people who obey laws cannot stand. Quote in the New York Times yesterday that should be intuitive for everybody from one of these demonstrators slash looters. No one is afraid to lose their jobs because there are no jobs.
Right. Well, you know, and by the way,
there is no opportunity for people, and small business owners should be allowed tomorrow to return to their businesses, to do whatever they can to reopen, to clean up, and to protect their investments.
Okay, so this is an important point because the people who live legally and follow the rules and all of that are then in a position where they can determine the level of their observance of lockdown protocols. In other words, if you're the way we've been living, you don't see other people, you don't socialize with other people, you go to stores and masks and maybe gloves, you know, you keep yourselves apart, you don't use mass transit, however you want to do it, people will still be able to observe those protocols if that is what makes them comfortable. As long as their employers don't demand that they return to work, right? If the employers don't demand that they return to on-site work, they can live the lockdown life with almost 100% certainty and security that they will not either get or pass on the virus. So you can end the lockdown regime. The lockdown regime is only put in place to force people who will not live by it to live by it anyway. And that, as we've seen, is over. That is over. Because nobody who is really afraid of the virus is out protesting, by definition. I mean, I have a friend. We had a socially distanced session the other day, and I, you know, this is what I mean. Like, and I came within 6 feet of him, and he stepped back. He was like, "I'm sorry, you know, we got to keep our distance." Now, I don't feel that way about this, but he does. He's an adult. He's a self-policing person. He self-policed. He wants 6 feet. He kept 6 feet away from me. We still socialized. That's how it works.
One of the interesting things about all the riots and protests in the last week is that the sort of traditional argument about the professional activist who's always ready, willing, and able to drop everything and run out and protest are that they tend to be young, unemployed or underemployed. They do not have young children. They do not have a lot of the responsibilities that would allow you, that they have freedom. They have the freedom to do that. And we know after several months of lockdown that more people have that freedom, not that they chose that. They don't have to be anywhere. They don't have anything to do. And so it's not a surprise that we see night after night of more violent activity and breaking curfew and doing all of these things, because what else, Noah's right, what else is there to do? And they don't feel any risk because right now there's no reward for them in the future unless they see a job opportunity or something. So, I mean, I was looking through the police log this morning that got sent around in our neighborhood of all the people who were arrested last night for breaking curfew. And there was only one person who was over the age of 30. Everybody else was young. And we didn't even see the juveniles. This is just people from the age of 18 to 25, basically. And yeah, they have no, what are they going to do? They're not in school. There are no activities. There are no camps. So this has been a situation where we've kind of weirdly turned the whole world into potential protesters.
Right.
Especially because, again, as you say, there's no social distancing possible or required in that.
John, you were prescient on this point, too. I just recall when Christine was talking.
Thanks, guys.
You said like months back. This goes on. Do you want young men standing around lighting fires in garbage cans?
Yeah.
You said that on the podcast.
Oh wow. I have no memory of that. But yeah. You know, basically, as long as you give people a reason to light fires in garbage cans because there's nothing else to do. And this is a reason. And to many people who are not violent, who are not looters, who are not interested in just, you know, causing violence, or, you know, anarchic, Antifa, whoever they are. They still, you know, they think by going out and being around all this, they are doing something noble, because they are outraged, as many people are, by the, you know, most of us are, by the killing of George Floyd, and they want to express their outrage. And that's the perfect cover for the I can't live like this anymore. Noah said for months after 2 weeks of the lockdown that it was unsustainable, but his presumption was that the demands of ordinary life would crack the would crack the lockdown. And I was always skeptical of that. So it turns out that it wasn't the demands of ordinary life. It was an extraordinary event that blew it up.
Well, while it was, and nobody foresaw that.
Right. Well, you can't by definition.
Right. But while we're patting ourselves on the back, I did on this podcast entertain the notion that there would be violent, organized civil unrest and civil disobedience.
Yes, you did.
I got a lot of side eye.
You did, but it wasn't about the lockdown. That's the whole point.
It was related to the lockdown.
But it needed to be about something else.
Well, and look, this is actually the point on which I have been agreeing with a lot of my extremely progressive friends. This is bad for everyone in the sense that the violence, the looting, the response to it, all of it distracts from what actually should be a national conversation about the police and about African Americans' experience with the police, which, in fact, until a lot of the sort of hijacking of some of these protests by violence and the looting and the kind of urban disarray that's been going on, until that happened, that was there were glimmers of that. There were very hopeful glimmers about that, I think, and that. To get that back on track, that's one of the things to answer the question, Abe, that you asked earlier about what Trump could do. A good leader could do that. Yeah. It doesn't have to be the president. It could be someone else. But we kind of have a void of national leadership in general. I mean, Biden just got up and made a statement where he acted as if he's never been in an elected office and isn't this terrible? Just elect him. I mean, he's a decades-long career politician who had a lot of power when previous riots occurred and when all this police brutality was happening. So the idea that it's not just that Trump is bad. It's that there's no one else either. I feel like there's a real void of national leadership here.
Well, has Biden condemned the looting at all?
He has. I mean, he used the language of it. You know,
it was some weak tea, though.
It was weak tea. But you know, someone said to me this morning, like, who's speaking? Who's speaking out? Who's speaking out? And I'm like, well, that's not the way it works. Like, politicians don't. You know, there's the president to speak nationally, and again, in that half-assed thing, the first major address that he gives the country is the one in which he reads the stage instructions yet again and says, I am the president of law and order. Well, you know, by the way, this is the other thing. I mean, if you're the president of law and order and the cities are in a condition of lawlessness and disorder, what are you saying? What are you saying? I mean, that's like, I don't think that's a good thing to say with split screen with, you know, people smashing a window, like, who's speaking? Well, by the way, we should mention one thing about Biden that is astonishing and yet gets to the point that he may end up being a president, but because of strange realities, but does not seem to be up to the job, was this sort of cast of mind he showed the other day where he started talking about what cops should really do and how, you know, what they should really do is shoot people in the leg. They should shoot people if they're, you know, people are aiming at them, they should shoot them in the leg. Well, it happens to be something I know a little about for weird reasons. All training, all military training that involves officials, cops, anybody like that, who have to use lethal force with a gun. They are trained laboriously over time to shoot at the torso, the trunk of the body. Why?
Center mass.
Why? Because if you don't shoot at the largest target on the body, which is the between the chin and the groin area, that bullet could go off somewhere else. It's actually harder to shoot someone in the leg. Like, you know, not everybody's a sniper. You're not James Coburn in The Magnificent Seven, you know.
The reason we all know this is not because we all have special police training or firearms training. It's because we were all privy to this debate for a decade when Joe Biden was vice president. Because we've been talking about the use of police lethal force for a decade. Right. And people with absolutely no understanding of how guns work have been saying, why don't we train police to shoot like they're in, a movie? and incapacitate people by aiming at extremities. We all know this because it's been talked about for a decade.
It's people, politicians in particular, out themselves immediately as never ever having handled, fired, cleaned a weapon when they speak like that. I mean, I'm surprised he didn't say turn it sideways to really like threaten them. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Right.
And then you walk
away.
And then as you walk away, things blow up behind you and you don't react. That's the other thing. You shoot someone in the leg and then you turn around and the building blows up behind you and you act like it didn't happen. So that is the possible next president of the United States suggesting that cops shoot people in the leg. So that's a really I would say hopeful sign for the future. So everything is terrible now, and we have absolutely no reason to think that everything won't be terrible in the future. And of course, that is where we end every podcast, with the crushing morosity that is our, you know, we should just change the name of the podcast to Crushing Morosity. We will endeavor to continue to depress you on a daily basis. For Abe, Christine, and Noah, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.